You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Lost and Found. Last August, a devastating explosion in Beirut demolished thousands of homes, including many of the city's opulent 19th-century villas. As the city rebuilds, one young photographer is determined to preserve its history. By Lily Leach, with photographs by Dia Murad. Opening photo, Rent Asunder. Inside Beirut's Sursak Palace, named for the aristocratic family that built its fortune during the Ottoman Empire, it is now slated to become an art museum and cultural center. And, next photo, a mural of Lebanese poet Gibran, Khalil Gibran, peeks through a demolished wall on historic Sursak Street. That particular photo of Gibran shows a bit of sadness in his eyes, Murad says. The moment I took the photo was very emotional for me. Dia Murad had a decent day job photographing homes for a real estate company in Beirut's classic Ashrafieh district, but he couldn't resist turning his camera toward palatial villas in the area that were very much off the market, icons of 19th-century Lebanese architecture whose occupants were reluctant to let him in. August 4, 2020 changed that, when just a couple kilometers away, 2,750 tons of improperly stored ammonium nitrate detonated at Beirut's port. One of the strongest non-nuclear explosions in history, it decimated an entire section of the city and killed more than 200 people, a stunning blow to a country already mired in an economic crisis that had sparked an historic wave of anti-government protest. After the blast, Murad's photographs of these architectural treasures began to circulate online, alongside photographs he took of their shattered remains. Some of the estate owners reached out, asking to use the photos for fundraising auctions and exhibitions. "It's sad," Murad, who is 30, says. "I can't believe this is the chance I got to visit these houses, literally in their worst situation ever." It was after a family vacation to France and Italy in 2019 that Murad returned home with the realization that Beirut has, if not more interesting architecture, then at least equally interesting architecture that is not really known when you think about Lebanon. Beirut tends to be represented in pop culture via xenophobic stereotypes about terrorism, conflict, and war. In movies, as Murad observes, it has a yellow filter. It seems dusty. None of them really show the architecture or the beauty of Beirut. Originally from Ras Baalbek in northeastern Lebanon, Murad spent time in Ashrafieh, particularly the Gemajia and Mar Makil neighborhoods, while studying architecture and working as a bartender. Most of Beirut's social life is there. Most of the creative spaces are in Gemajia. The studios, the agencies, media, everything that has to do with arts and culture. On the evening of August 4th, Murad had just pulled up his Vespa to photograph an apartment in Mar Makil. He was looking at his phone when the initial blast hit. Less than a minute later, the massive shock wave from the second explosion threw him off his bike and unleashed chaos for miles around. "The first thing I did after getting up from under the bike was shoot a video with my camera," he recalls. After shuttling an injured young woman on the back of his bike to a hospital, he returned to Gemajia, camera in hand. "I had this instinct to just continue shooting, in the same pattern as before, shooting the same buildings again, but they were all destroyed," he says. "A big part of it was I felt that this could keep me sane, But the biggest part was to be able to really demonstrate the impact of this explosion on architecture. The morning after the explosion, Murad made his way to Ashrafieh's historic Sursak Street, lined with the 19th-century villas that represent the apex of Lebanese architecture, the most elaborate, the most decorative, he says. They were the richest families in their time, and they had access to the best materials, the best builders, the best everything. An exterior wall of one villa had completely collapsed, revealing a face peering through rubble, a mural of Khalil Gibran, the renowned Lebanese artist and poet who settled in New York's Greenwich Village in the early 20th century. "The moment I took the photo was very emotional for me," Murad says, recalling the haunting split second before he made sense of what he was seeing. "I thought it was a real person there. I had goosebumps." This photo was widely shared online, and he later sold a print for $5,500 at a reconstruction charity auction. Sursak Street gets its name from the prominent Ottoman-era family that also built Sursak Palace, which, until last year, was the private residence of glamorous national icon Ivan Sursak, better known as Lady Cochrane. She died on August 31st, at the age of 98, after being injured in the explosion, having dedicated much of her life to preserving Lebanon's heritage. Murad now finds himself on a similar mission. "I have a whole new appreciation for her. We at least owe it to her to keep pushing that narrative of heritage preservation," he says. "It's essential that Sursak Palace is renovated. It doesn't feel like something you can expect to find inside Beirut, this spaciousness. But as a matter of fact, this was the original Beirut, which is very far from our imagination. There are plans to turn the palace into an art museum, but Murad thinks that all of Ashrafieh's architectural treasures should be available to visitors. It's our heritage. We should be able to see it." Blue Notes, as Moonlight director Barry Jenkins turned Colson Whitehead's award-winning novel, The Underground Railroad, into a TV series, he unraveled his own story. Beckermanni Felix, with opening Photograph of the Author by John Edmonds, styled by Jason Rembert. I think often of those 8 minutes of the 2017 Oscars where the thing that no one ever considered might happen actually happened. In a world where black talent, especially talent that highlights the tender interiority of black queerness and poverty, feels perpetually overlooked, hearing Jordan Horowitz say the words, "I'm sorry, no, there's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture," felt like a triumph on its own. I cringe when I think of how the room went dead silent. Poor Fred Berger's hopelessness as he finishes his acceptance speech with, "We lost, by the way, but, you know." We are all so used to black erasure at the service of white achievement that that moment felt inevitable, and yet sacrosanct, like it was sticking its tongue out at the Academy, Megan Thee Stallion style. The racial implications and significance of that moment aren't lost on Barry Jenkins, as he's noted in many an interview. The work is not something that I'm trying to do as a rebuttal of the white gaze. It's honestly something I don't give a shit about, he tells me. But that doesn't make him oblivious to it. He knows it's there. He's just trying to keep the gaze out of the way. When the trades reported that he would adapt Colson Whitehead's novel, The Underground Railroad, into a TV series, it was incredibly well received. But with a side of some fair and familiar skepticism, skepticism that Jenkins has the patience to sit with, because he gets the overarching critique, but also because he thinks that with Underground, he's gotten it right. The reason why there's skepticism around these stories is because it's almost become default that in order to receive the funds to create them, in order to break through, they have to be centered on the white gaze, or the white characters, he says in an interview we conduct over Zoom. I feel like with this show, that was not the case. Even though Jenkins says he ordinarily prefers film over episodic storytelling, when he first spoke to Whitehead, he told the author that a film wouldn't do it justice. A series was the only way. The late Toni Morrison says, in The Pieces I Am, I have spent my entire writing life trying to make sure that the white gaze was not the dominant one in any of my books. Jenkins seems to share this urgency and the implicit desire to illustrate the preciousness and perpetual innovation of black survival. It's not even that he's making black movies for black people. That's too simple of a mission statement, as he said before. It's that, at this point in his career, he is breaking the fourth wall to help black people look themselves in the eye. "So I'm standing in this cotton field as we're scouting for the show," Jenkins says. It's the cotton field in episode one, and standing there, I thought to myself, I could buy all the cotton I can see with my eyes right now and burn it to the effing ground. And I imagined that no one who ever stood in this field picking cotton could ever imagine that there would be a day when that would be the case, that me, a young black man born into poverty, would be able to afford to just burn this entire field to the ground. Then I realized, yes, they must have. I ask Jenkins if he thinks he is free. I can see that he is dubious at first. "Am I free?" he questions. "In what way?" "I mean in the most profound way," I say, as in, like, do you think that you're a free black man? He takes a beat to consider, rubbing at the pink collar of his shirt, and finally says, "Yes, I do." "And yet," he continues, "that freedom has conditions." Blue is his favorite color. At his dining room table, he sways from left to right, adjusting in his chair. He laughs a bit to break the silence and manages to avoid looking directly at the camera, his eyes darting to the corners of the room or casting downward, his hand gripping his chin as he speaks. Behind him is a wall that looks like it's been papered in a beautiful jungle-inspired print. But it's paint, the work of a local artist who splattered a mesmerizing system of pinks, greens, grays, and blue streaks of varying opacities onto a midnight-colored base. It's the blues that stand out. A few strokes of blue paint circle his head like a halo. His very blue jean jacket hugs him like a blanket. In this home he's just moved into with his partner, director Lulu Wang, the color blue is alive, just as it is in Jenkins' work. Its significance dances through the Underground Railroad, as it did in Moonlight, as it did in If Beale Street Could Talk, insisting that we recognize the soft vulnerability of black skin. Jenkins says that blue has been his favorite color since he was a kid, that it's a color from which he draws emotion. How it shows up in his work is both intuitive and intentional. He says that he can't necessarily intellectualize why it's his favorite, but that its use is, at least in part, inspired by the artist Cary James Marshall. According to Jenkins, Marshall has a very interesting relationship to the color black, and with how he builds his colors with the absence of white pigment. For Underground, he says, they used a process for building the shades of blue that he would incorporate into the Moonlight. As the show goes on, it sort of evolves. In the first episode of the Amazon series, the blue moonlight inks the night and falls around the main character, Cora, and the young black man she attempts to protect, as an expected but horrifying violence occurs. You see immediately that the color has shown up as a guide to help us truly understand the physical cost of slavery on African bodies, to understand the cost of black defiance and the inhumanity of white domination. Before I watched The Underground Railroad, it had been a while since I'd really confronted my own feelings about slave narratives depicted for television and in film. One of my earliest memories is of my father playing the 1997 Steven Spielberg-directed movie Amistad one Saturday morning. I almost vomited from terror as black bodies that looked like that of my family tossed themselves into the vast ocean, dripping with the blood of their captors. Eventually, my parents introduced dramas like Roots, 1977, Sankofa, 1993, and Night John, 1996, to my memory bank. I ultimately felt as haunted by these works as I felt grateful for them. So grateful, in fact, that I thought they were all I needed to see of American slavery on film. I felt little need to watch depictions that came out when I was older, like 12 Years a Slave, Django Unchained, or The Birth of a Nation, though ultimately I did see most of those, usually at the behest of a friend during a group movie night. Each time, I came away with the sensation of being in a room where everyone was talking about me, but no one was talking to me at all. I came away from the first episode of The Underground Railroad feeling something different entirely. I came away, though I had suffered, feeling immense wonder and relief. Jenkins grew up in Liberty City, Florida, one of the blackest and poorest neighborhoods in Miami, during the crack era of the 80s and 90s, where he was extremely, bitterly lonely. His mother, who worked as a nurse's aide and had survived sexual abuse, suffered drug addiction while Jenkins was still young. Unable to locate any sense of safety in a turbulent childhood, he withdrew into the tender hold of his own mind. "I think it made me a really good observer," he says, "and gave me an active imagination." Jenkins took that imagination to film school, where he learned the art of turning his thoughts into images other people could see, too. First, he made a short film called My Josephine about an Arabic-speaking young man who finds love while working at a laundromat in the aftermath of 9/11. Then, Little Brown Boy, about the fate of black children tried as adults for the deaths of other black kids. and then Medicine for Melancholy, a movie I return to over and over about the illicit relationship of a young black couple in a rapidly gentrifying San Francisco. He is working methodically, and with each film you can see Jenkins' command of the intimate start to break through, the silences of his childhood showing up bit by bit. It wasn't until 15 years after My Josephine that the world was punched in the gut with Moonlight. Jenkins became the breakout of the year. But to become the director who makes Moonlight, he had to be the director who made Little Brown Boy and Medicine for Melancholy. And to become the director who makes The Underground Railroad, he had to be the director who can claim Moonlight as his breakout. The beauty, the fortune, the privilege that I have right now is that with each iteration of my aesthetic, it's kind of becoming clear, he says, this is who the F. Barry Jenkins is. It was the childhood memory of first learning about the Underground Railroad, imagining that it was a real train with real stops and real stations, that drew him in and compelled him to adapt Whitehead's book, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and the National Book Award for Fiction, and spent nearly a year on the New York Times bestsellers list, among other accolades. After Cora agrees to run away with her lover Caesar on the Underground Railroad, you see them flee deep into the blue-black night, weaving through rows of cotton. After narrowly escaping a set of hog hunters who've become alerted of their attempt, Cora and Caesar descend into an underground tunnel, where they discover raised tracks in the ground. It is otherworldly, a thing they have never seen. When the big black train pulls into the station at the end, an image serenely and perfectly out of place, I breathe for the first time in 45 minutes. The whole episode leads up to this moment of exquisite surrealist bliss, and the pain is suddenly worth it. Next photos, young Cora, Michaela Kimani Armstrong, and her mother Mabel, Sheila Atim. Mebadu working with Barry Jenkins. Mebadu on one of the show's uncannily impressionistic sets. When I think about the first episode, you know, 7 minutes in, you're getting a very sharp depiction of trauma. But I love that just before that, you have these two lovers standing in a field. They're having almost a Shakespearean conversation in a certain way, says Jenkins. In a very nuanced way, even amidst the trauma, the people, the characters, still retain their humanity. And because of that, I think their personhood remains intact. The condition of slavery is not a thing that's fixed or static or that has fidelity to them as persons. These things are being visited upon them. And it's when he says this that I realize that Jenkins knows something about how we get to the other side of trauma, to the haunting magic of the things that destroy us, how to get to, dance in, and replicate that wonder. If there is shame in these images, he says, the shame is not ours. So much of art making is carving blind in the night and awaking the next morning to see what you've built. You won't always know what you're doing until it's done. Jenkins calls this his tunnel vision. Among other things the show is about, he says, it's about my mom and me learning in my 20s that so many of her problems were built around assault and a broken heart. And the shame, it isn't mine, but it isn't hers either. When I ask Whitehead, who is an executive producer, what made him trust Jenkins, he gives two reasons. First, after he saw Moonlight, he was blown away by Jenkins' ability to see his characters. Barry kept everyone's essential humanity foregrounded, even in the face of tragedy and trauma and brutality. And the second, I had to interview him before I signed off. And, you know, I don't know what to ask filmmakers. Are there any slavery movies that inspired you or that you look to for inspiration? He was like, slave movies? No, I was thinking Anderson's There Will Be Blood and The Master. And I was like, okay, you got it. You say two of my favorite movies in the last 20 years or so, take it. And while Jenkins stays true to the novel, which he read and reread throughout the process, Jenkins knew it was up to him to give the script its own universe. I remember my grandmother used to keep a penny in a jar under the bed, he says. These things are very tactile objects that gain sublimated, surrealistic, spiritual qualities just through this sense of belief, through something within the person that is giving the item its power. And so no one's going to levitate in this show, but there's a way to build images to where you feel like something mystical is happening. Jenkins knows what constrains him. In If Beale Street Could Talk, he changes James Baldwin's 1974 ending to give his mostly black viewership a happy ending, or at least a happier one. Jenkins has the power to change the parameters of the original experience to fit his understanding of what a good cinematic experience of this work would feel like for viewers, especially black ones. If you go purely by the ending of the book, then this child in the last 3 pages or 3 minutes of the story loses both its grandfather and his father, and I just couldn't have that on my soul. I ask Jenkins if he feels lonely, and first he says no. He has his love, Lulu, a partnership that he says inspires and adds rigor to creative practice. They're both from Miami and met through a mutual friend, another filmmaker. It's funny, I have friends who say directors should never be in a relationship, and I guess maybe if both the directors are raging narcissists, then that could be the case. Says Wang separately, I always felt like everything was in competition with my work versus my personal life, my freedom versus domesticity. You know, particularly, I think as a female in this world, as a straight female in this world who has relationships with straight men, so I had this vision for the kind of relationship I wanted, which was that swing in the amusement park that spins with all the strings. She compares the relationship to an infinite tether between exploring the world and a connection to home. We both are expansive. We want each other to continue to grow. Their relationship, says Jenkins, is naturally, organically very giving and selfless, and quarantine has taught them that they are the perfect pair, the antidote to the doom. Plus there's the dog, so yeah, all that's hitting. But then he takes a breath and looks off to the side of the room, pensively. Actually, yeah, I am lonely. He means a different kind of loneliness, a more insidious one, especially with this one, because it's such a long journey. And in this case, sometimes writing with the camera, a lot of times I can't explain to someone. You don't have time to explain to someone why you're doing something or what the intent of the thing is. Because in explaining it, you kind of lose grasp of it. You kind of have to keep a part of yourself closed off. That loneliness doesn't go away. It takes on a different quality. Jenkins is a man who likes his solitude. He loves to write and to walk the yard of his new home, to sit out in the sun, to feel the intimacy of its warmth and the glow of the pool he never uses. He's writing a script with Leonardo DiCaprio for a feature adaptation of the documentary Virunga about Congolese park rangers fighting to protect endangered gorillas amid oil company exploitation. Even though it's real heavy shit, getting to write that script and be in its world is relaxing. When Jenkins was on the way home from Press Week in New York City, TSA inspected a Cary James Marshall monograph that he had bought at Marshall's Met Brewer exhibition. Ominously, the officers left behind a note, letting him know that they'd inspected it. This event, he says, really got inside of him. A reminder that this threat perception and the surveillance inherent to it is one of the conditions of being a free black man making black art in a Western society. Marshall, who is slightly ahead of him in this, has become a rabbi of sorts, a guide, or even a kind of father figure. Jenkins listens to every lecture and every Q&A. When I'm around the house or I'm in the car, I just put him on and I listen to him speak. And you know why? I don't know that I hear loneliness in his voice. Jenkins cocks his head to the side and smiles, not effusive but almost childlike, as if he's suddenly warming from a brisk cold. But I feel a little bit less alone when I'm listening to him. Shot Chasers by Catherine Aben, with opening Photograph of the White House by Tom Brenner. In the Trump administration's final weeks, a secretive effort to vaccinate essential federal workers bred suspicion, infighting, and shameless attempts to jump the line. In late December and early January, as COVID-19 vaccines were just beginning their chaotic rollout to the states, a furtive scramble took place inside the Trump White House. One after another, political appointees at very high levels approached Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and members of the National Security Council to ask a favor. They wanted to be on the list. It was, to be sure, the ultimate VIP list. On it were the names of U.S. government officials whose work was considered so essential that they needed to be vaccinated against COVID-19 from a limited supply that would otherwise have gone to the general public. The allotment was intended to protect career staff who could not telecommute, such as White House butlers, critical workers in the field, such as Secret Service agents, and those in the line of presidential succession, such as the Secretary of State. The question of who was eligible in an outgoing administration, with just weeks remaining until the inauguration of a new president, was complex. To make the cut, your role had to be essential to national functions. The quest to get on the White House list, which was closely guarded by Meadows' office and a small cadre of NSC officials, attracted an array of supplicants. They ranged from the representatives of cabinet secretaries to young White House desk jockeys to those prepared to leverage their connections to President Donald Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Among this group, Vanity Fair has learned, were chiefs of staff of cabinet agencies, some of whose bosses had become notorious for publicly disregarding pandemic safeguards, like mask wearing. They wanted to know, would they be able to get 4 or 6 doses for their front office, said a former senior administration official. Though some would claim to be inquiring on behalf of their teams, the official said, in fact, their ask was not about their employees. Though it is not clear who ultimately succeeded in crashing the list, which morphed continuously as names were punted off it and then mysteriously reappeared, most petitioners ran into a surprisingly hard line. "It ain't happening," was a common refrain, said one career official familiar with the decision-making. In part, this was because Meadows, who, like many working in the White House, contracted COVID-19 late last year, had received explicit directions from his boss. On December 13th, Trump tweeted that White House employees would wait their turn unless specifically necessary. But in a White House awash in special favors, that didn't stop almost every stripe of political appointee at almost every rung of the ladder from shamelessly attempting to jump the line, according to a former senior administration official. Meadows and Trump did not respond to request for comment. Why, in a White House infamous for flouting pandemic precautions, would some political appointees in the executive branch show such determination in attempting to score a shot? According to the former senior administration official, the answer is simple enough. Vaccinations would enable these high-flying rule flouters to maintain their active lifestyles. The previously unreported competition over the White House list was just one front in a sprawling secret war that raged for months at the highest levels of the federal government. The question of how to equitably vaccinate a federal workforce of 2.1 million people in the midst of a presidential transition ended up pitting the NSC against officials from Operation Warp Speed and career staff against political appointees. It also sparked resentment, suspicions over missing doses, and allegations of line jumping. And it all played out against the backdrop of a critical shortage of vaccine doses across the nation. In the waning days of the Trump administration, with nearly 2,500 Americans dying of COVID-19 every day, what had been envisioned as a triumphant vaccine rollout soon devolved into Hunger Games-style chaos. As vulnerable residents struggled to score shots in fragmented state sign-up systems, governors furiously blamed federal officials at Operation Warp Speed for continually revising the number of doses they would receive. Underlying all this was an unforgiving zero-sum math equation. In December and January, the program had roughly 70 million doses to fully vaccinate 35 million Americans with first and second shots. to be divided on a per capita basis among 64 jurisdictions, including 50 states, 8 territories, and 6 large metropolitan areas. By definition, any dose given to anyone, whether in the states or in the State Department, would be taken from someone else, given the lack of any surplus. No one disputed that the federal government ought to reserve a portion of vaccinations in order to protect its own essential workforce. But from there, the questions got much thornier. Did employees within a White House that flouted safeguards and was holding maskless holiday parties deserve a shot? What about Department of the Interior firefighters dousing flames on federal lands, or Border Patrol agents in pursuit of undocumented immigrants? The early incarnation of the U.S. government's plan to vaccinate its workers, which Vanity Fair pieced together in interviews with 33 current and former federal employees, was the product of an orderly and thoughtful process spearheaded by the National Security Council. By late spring, the NSC's Resilience Directorate began an effort to identify employees who were critical to national essential functions, which are those jobs needed to sustain the country amid a catastrophe. Many of the roles identified were classified and related to intelligence activities. The Resilience Directorate's effort, involving months of classified deliberations, resulted in a tight list of fewer than 12,000 essential employees across the three branches of government. These employees were so crucial that under the NSC plan, the U.S. government would vaccinate them directly. At the same time, the directorate also helped guide the creation of a separate and larger set of lists identifying workers who would be eligible for priority vaccinations in their respective states. Those workers met guidelines developed by the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which outlined critical jobs ranging from frontline health care to the maintenance of nuclear reactors and handling of hazardous materials. Working with the Resilience Directorate, the White House's Office of Management and Budget invited federal agencies to tally up those workers. Then it sent the resulting spreadsheets, essentially headcounts by agency, to the states, with instructions to set aside a corresponding number of doses during the initial rollout. The two sets of lists, though distinct, were assembled using consistent guidelines. That was the most legitimate process you had, said the former senior administration official. It was not going to be a boondoggle. The story of how it became one reflects the larger MO of the Trump administration, said a federal official who worked on the pandemic response. You had a functioning government that did its due diligence, only to be thwarted by arbitrary and secretive decisions. That's what happened with every single thing in the White House. It was autumn of 2020 when OMB began its outreach to federal agencies, asking them to submit headcounts of their frontline employees. We ask agencies to really think through, were those employees teleworking? Could they mitigate against exposure? Were they able to maintain social distancing versus law enforcement or border patrol? What is the immediate need for their agencies, said a former administration official who participated in the effort. We gathered that information. We consolidated it and distributed it to the states. The federal agencies were then supposed to follow up with state immunization directors to coordinate delivering the shots. But that relatively democratic process soon collided with the secretive decision-making culture inside Operation Warp Speed. The multi-billion-dollar government program launched last spring was a collaboration among the Pentagon, the Department of Health and Human Services, and a number of pharmaceutical companies to dramatically accelerate the development and production of COVID-19 vaccines and therapies. The four-star general, Gustav F. Perna, was in charge of logistics, and Secretary of Health and Human Services Alex Azar oversaw his efforts. Even to some Operation Warp Speed board members, it seemed that the two men operated with little input from others. And when the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention sent Perna a proposal to meet regularly to review decisions about the distribution of vaccinations, it was met with crickets, according to a CDC official. A Pentagon spokesperson said, "There's nothing I'm aware of that Perna didn't respond to." In October, a new set of allocations materialized. Allotments of COVID-19 vaccines were approved for five agencies: the Department of Defense, the State Department, the Bureau of Prisons, the Indian Health Service, and the Department of Veterans Affairs, which shared its doses with the Department of Homeland Security. The amounts initially allocated to the departments, which were not publicly disclosed, were small enough. The State Department received 13,000 doses, and the Indian Health Service got fewer than 20,000, a source familiar with the allotment said. In December, the Defense Department got 44,000 doses, according to an email obtained by Vanity Fair from the director of the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. A Health and Human Services spokesperson for COVID response told Vanity Fair that among a host of considerations, those agencies were chosen because of their large patient care functions and ability to store and administer the vaccine. But the sudden, unexplained appearance of COVID-19 vaccination clinics within the federal government for some workers and not others ignited a wildfire of whispers, denunciations, and comparisons to the Titanic, with first-class passengers elbowing their way onto scarce lifeboats. The moves they were pulling were unorthodox, said the former senior administration official. These other agencies were getting it outside of a formal interagency process. Who exactly was making these decisions? It depends on whom you ask. A Pentagon spokesperson for Perna told Vanity Fair, "The decision to allocate doses to any federal agency is approved by the HHS secretary." But the office of former Secretary Azar said in a statement, "Secretary Azar did not make, review, or approve allocation decisions. Such decisions, according to the statement, were made by the CDC and the leadership and board of Operation Warp Speed." But one CDC official said the agency was never involved in decision-making about how much vaccine would go to the five federal entities, and was quite concerned there didn't seem to be a process for determining the amounts. The operation was so opaque that even members of the Operation Warp Speed Board and the White House COVID-19 Task Force say they were left in the dark. When several caught wind of the seemingly random vaccinations of healthy, young federal employees, they suspected that vaccine doses were being siphoned without clear accounting from the nation's overall supply, Vanity Fair has learned. When one task force member contacted Perna, demanding to know where the doses were coming from and going to, the request was met with radio silence, said the person involved. "I can't emphasize enough how secretive it was," that person said, adding, "You could never get to the bottom of who made the decisions. It was one of those two, Perna or Azar, or those two together." Ask why Perna didn't respond to questions from the Trump administration's task force members, a Pentagon spokesperson said he briefed the White House COVID task force on January 21, 2021, the first full day of the Biden administration. The spokesperson added that an HHS computer system called Tiberius provides vaccine accountability and can be audited. In agency after agency, employees in critical roles were stunned to learn that they weren't eligible for a shot. On January 13th, the Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees numerous agencies, including the Food and Drug Administration and the CDC, held an intra-agency video call. When one participant asked when HHS employees would be notified about vaccination schedules, the answer came back that no one outside of the Indian Health Service could expect a dose. At that, the room just lost their shit, with everyone speaking at once, one attendee recounted. Paul Mango, the former Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy at Health and Human Services, who was centrally involved in Operation Warp Speed, justified the distribution decisions, saying, "We wanted to set up a governance process so it didn't become, I'm doing favors for you and not for you. Then the floodgates would have opened." Nevertheless, resentment brewed as young, healthy, teleworking employees in some agencies scored vaccinations, while others facing extreme perils could not. One example underscores the absurdity of the arrangement. A team of infectious disease experts from the CDC, who were deploying to Guinea and the Democratic Republic of Congo to fight an Ebola outbreak, were vaccinated against Ebola, but not COVID, despite the evident hazards they faced, Vanity Fair has learned. "Those employees have since been vaccinated," said a CDC spokesperson. "The entire fiasco of the distribution falls to Perna," said one HHS official. "We knew that the Department of Defense was extremely well taken care of. The intelligence community was. And then there was everybody else." In the months leading up to the release of COVID-19 vaccines, all three branches of government held classified meetings to refine the far smaller list of federal employees critical enough to get a direct vaccination. That list, which was separate from both the state spreadsheets and the allocations Perna divvied up among the five agencies, covered such high-value individuals as Supreme Court justices and intelligence agents in the field. But in the last week of November, Perna upended that process too, Vanity Fair has learned. He declared to those involved that any federal agency wanting a direct allocation had to brief him in person. Perna's team informed National Security Council officials that if they wanted to save the list that had been months in the making, they would have to come kiss the ring. Those whose agencies had employees on the list, such as the Director of National Intelligence, got similar instructions. Suddenly, what had been an organized, well-considered process became an arbitrary one, overseen by Perna. The question was why. Some with knowledge of the process suspected that, due to manufacturing and dosage shortfalls, Perna could not deliver on commitments he'd made to the states, and so he was trying to whittle down the allocation to federal employees. On December 19th, Perna acknowledged overpromising to the states, saying, "I want to take personal responsibility for the miscommunication." In the second week of December, in a secure meeting room, several NSC officials defended their plan for the roughly 12,000 direct vaccinations in a meeting with Perna and a handful of his deputies. Tensions erupted almost immediately, according to three officials familiar with what occurred. After listening to the NSC request, Perna refused to sign off. Evidently unimpressed with the seniority of the NSC emissaries, he said, "I don't take orders from a child. You can have your adult give me directions." As tempers flared, Perna added, "I don't give a damn what you people think." According to the officials, Brian Kavanaugh, a special assistant to the president and senior director for resilience policy at the NSC, told Perna, "You need a piece of paper in writing, so when you get subpoenaed by Congress, you can feel good about yourself." This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.